Gortler, interviewing Mildred Cohn in her office at the University of Pennsylvania on January 6th, 1988. This is the second interview in this series.
You told me that you hadn't covered much about the intellectual climate at Columbia during the period that you were there, and perhaps you could tell me a little bit about that now.
Okay. It was really a very exciting time, particularly in physical chemistry, or chemical physics, the term which Urey invented and started the journal of chemical physics. He disapproved of our seminar. There was a graduate student seminar in physical chemistry, which was essentially a journal club where students had to report on current papers in the literature. And I have forgotten who ran that, either Professor Lamaire or Professor Hammett, or perhaps both of them. Well, he didn't think that was a worthwhile kind of seminar. So he started his own, and that one was called Chemical Physics. And his system of conducting that seminar was that he usually chose a postdoc or someone at that level, not a graduate student, but someone above, but not too far above, to make a bibliography of a given subject. For example, we did one series, and these would last several months, you see. There would be perhaps 10 or 12 seminars in a given area. We covered subjects like artificial radioactivity, which had just been accomplished by Fermi, and we covered absolute reaction rate theory. Eyring had just come out with his theory, and so on. And another subject we covered was separation methods for isotopes. That was his particular thing. But I learned more in those seminars than I did in any courses that I took. They were very good. The graduate students actually presented the material. The person in charge, who was, as I say, either a postdoc or maybe a new assistant professor, would give an overview, you see. And actually, when we did the radioactive isotopes, he imported someone from the physics department to give the overview and make up the relevant bibliography. And the bibliography, the students were supposed to read all the papers, and they had to present one of them, each student. By the way, those seminars, the first seminar that you gave at Columbia as a graduate student, was really a baptism by fire. I saw one man, he was about 6'2", great big fellow, and he almost fainted. He kept drinking water and so on. And in Urey's, I remember there was a young woman. She stopped in the middle of a seminar, walked out, and never showed up again. It was, and I remember in this chemical physics seminar, the first row the professors would sit. They all came, by the way, Hammett and Lamaire and all the senior professors came. And then the junior professors, and then the postdocs and the students in the back. It was that kind of thing. But it was really a very, very exciting, because it was all current, and we went into it in some depth, you see, rather than these journal club things, which varied from week to week in subject, and were never gone into in depth. They were like mini courses, really. But it was a very exciting time because of the fact that, you know, Urey was separating the isotopes. Here, Fermi had made everything radioactive, and reaction rate theory in chemistry was coming out. We also studied O.K. Rice's because one of his collaborators, one of his thesis students, was a postdoc. And he had also worked with Eyring, so he was in charge of that. And then Hammett was doing all these very interesting things with chemical reactions and so on, of substituted groups and all that. That was going on all the time I was there, you see. And also in the physics department, because I took a good many courses in physics, and because of my contact with Robbie, I knew that some very exciting things were going on there as well. So the whole place was really quite exciting, you see. By the way, Fermi came over in the summers and used to give courses I listened in on one of them. I didn't take it for credit.
Okay. Was Fermi at Columbia at that time?
No, he was in Italy still, you see.
Oh, he came over from Italy.
Came from Italy for the summer.
Okay, he hadn't left Italy yet.
No.
Right.
He had not yet left Italy. This was, 1935, 36, something like that. So it was, as I say, a very exciting period to be at Columbia because of all the things that were going on there. Of course, a student doesn't quite have the perspective, but when it's exciting, you know it's exciting. So I just did want to tell you that because I remember it with great fondness as far as the intellectual.
I think it's important that had come away with that, because I know there were other aspects of the experience that you were not quite so happy with.
That's true. But as far as what was going on there scientifically, it was a very excellent place to be. And also the fact that Urey was so enthusiastic and interested in all these other things that he wasn't working on, you understand. He organized a seminar so that they could be gone into in some depth. So, all in all, I had a very good experience there from the intellectual point of view.
Last time we had gotten you into Duvigneau's group.
Yes.
Now, tell me a little bit about working with Duvigneau. And I noticed that his name appears on almost all of your papers from...
Oh, yes, and he was always first author.
Mm-hmm.
You see, all the papers, well, except one, he didn't want to put his name on. I don't know why. Then you felt he didn't respect the work or something and didn't think it was important. He had very high standards. I remember, for example, I did, most of the time I was there, I worked on transmethylation because that had been discovered accidentally because of the use of the isotopes. I don't know whether you want me to recount that story. It's, I think, a very interesting one. But he himself has written an autobiography called A Trail of Research, which I should have a copy of, where he more or less describes this discovery. But I was very impressed with his recognizing what was going on. I should tell you, this is sufficiently interesting, I think, so that it should be told, because it influenced my whole intellectual attitude towards science when I saw this kind of thing. He had very high standards, he really did. And unless a thing had been done, two, three times, the same experiment, he didn't accept it. Well, as you know, I was brought there to work with isotopes. One of the problems, he was primarily interested in amino acid metabolism, and in particular, sulfur amino acids. There were three experts in the country of whom he was one. And he was interested in knowing how homocysteine, substituted for methionine in the rat, methionine is an essential amino acid. About half the amino acids are essential, namely the rats can't synthesize them from other things. And one of them is methionine. And it had been shown by several people that homocysteine, which is not a natural amino acid, got converted, could substitute for methionine in the diet of a rat. The criterion of substitution was that the rats grew. Otherwise, they didn't grow if you gave them, if they were missing one amino acid, essential amino acid. Well, when I came there, he had synthesized homocysteine with deuterium in the alpha and beta positions. I think it was alpha and beta. Maybe beta and delta. I don't know. I think it was alpha and beta. I don't remember now, but certainly on the beta. And when he fed these rats pure amino acid diets, which, by the way, entailed making about 10 of them, because only about 10 of them or so were available commercially. So in the summer, the whole laboratory ceased doing research except me. I was not a synthetic chemist, so. And they either synthesized these other amino acids for the rest of the year, or they isolated them. For example, cysteine was isolated from hair, but on a large scale, because there were a lot of rats that were going to be fed these pure amino acid diets. So when he did this, he also added to the diets all the then known pure vitamins. And the rats did not grow. Now, Brand, who was one of the other three sulfur amino acid people, this I'm telling you because of the attitude of the biochemists at that time toward isotopes. He immediately said, it's the isotope that's doing them in, the deuterium on the homocysteine. They were very suspicious of isotopes, and they didn't want to accept the use of them as a harmless kind of thing to do. Well, Davinia, of course, immediately tried homocysteine without any deuterium, and they didn't grow. Now, Rose at Illinois was doing the same type of experiments, and his rats were growing. So Davinia sent the rats, he was then at George Washington University, he sent the rats from Washington, D.C. to Urbana, Illinois, and the Urbana rats arrived in Washington. And the Urbana rats did not grow in Washington, and Davinia's rats did grow in Illinois. So Davinia then looked carefully at the protocol as to see what was the difference. And he looked at the diets, and they were both feeding pure amino acids. But when it came to the vitamins, Davinia was using pure vitamin, the various vitamin Bs, but Rose was using something called Tiki Tiki, which is rice polishings, which has all the vitamin B complexes in it as a source of vitamin B. Mm-hmm. Davinia looked at that and said, choline, transmethylation from nitrogen to sulfur. And he immediately added choline to the diet, and the rats grew. Now, I thought that was a remarkable thing. I was there when he did it, so it was amazing that he could, first of all, choline isn't usually considered a vitamin because it's present in the diet in fairly large amounts, but he knew that Tiki Tiki had choline in it, and he, of course, knew what choline was, and it was an N-methyl compound, and he immediately made that jump. And then did experiments to prove it, and indeed that was the case. That was the discovery of transmethylation. Now, the interesting thing, as he has pointed out himself in talking to me, I don't know if he's ever done it in print, is that if at that time one had known all of the vitamins, he would never have discovered transmethylation. Because if you have folic acid, you can make methyl groups from one carbon fragments, you see. But when there's no folic acid, you can't do that. And so the way the body does it is... Then he investigated. Then I was given the job of making deuteromethyl alcohol. I think I told you that the last time I went in Zanetti's lab.
I asked you about that paper, because that's a major paper that you had with him. You made the deuteromethyl, and then you showed that...
Well, then he made methyl iodide, and he made methionine and choline from it, mm-hmm. from the methyl iodide. And... Of course, even today, the compound that is, you see, he only worked in whole animals, so he couldn't get the intermediate steps. But actually, it was Cantoni who discovered that the true methylating intermediate is S-adenosyl methionine. And to this day, it's the central compound of transmethylation, of methylating everything from making creatine and choline to making, putting the methyl groups on nucleic acids, for example.
I'm sorry, what was the compound? Adenosyl?
S-adenosyl. It's on the sulfur of the adenosyl, methionine. That's the central compound. It's a very important compound because it methylates everything that has to be methylated. There are other pathways, though, as I say, there are these one carbon fragments. But this is the main pathway of methylation in the body. And methylation is very important in lots and lots of steps of structures of biological compounds. The methyl group can make the difference between being an active substrate and an inactive one, and so on. So I worked most of the years on transmethylation, because then he went into finding out, did the methyl group, for example, of methionine go to creatine, and it does, then to succosine, and so on. I mean, he tried out a number of known methylated compounds in the body, and found that methionine, the methyl group methionine, ended up there. And all these were in rats. I mean, all these experiments were done in rats. And so I spent 8.5 years of my life working with rats. However, I did all the deuterium analyses and planned all the experiments, actually, so that they would come out with a significant amount of deuterium so that we could detect it.
The analytical method must have been extremely tedious. You had to isolate the compounds, then you burn the compounds, and you isolated the water.
Purified the water, and then measured its density. You couldn't do more than 2, at most 3 a day, because of this combustion. Even after it was isolated, you understand, that was no easy task. Now, there's another experiment. He was interested, as I told you, not only in this homocysteine to methionine question, but he was also interested in whether there are 2 sulfur containing amino acids. One is methionine, the other one is cysteine. Now, cysteine is a non-essential one. That's from the dietary point of view, but from the viewpoint of the body, cysteine, of course, is really much more important than, well, it's hard to say. But it certainly is as important as methionine. And the question he was interested in was, how was methionine converted to cysteine? Because cysteine is non-essential, so the sulfur obviously must come from there. Was the whole carbon chain used, or just the sulfur? And so he had a man who was a good organic chemist synthesize methionine labeled with sulfur 34 and carbon 13. You must realize that at that time there was no tritium or C14 available. In fact, they hadn't been discovered, though maybe by the time we did that experiment they had just been discovered. But they certainly were not available. So that took a year to synthesize that compound. And then we had to feed this compound, which, by the way, we fed by stomach tube. We weren't going to let them slop around with these valuable compounds. The whole diet was given to them by stomach tube. The rat was shaved before the experiment began, and then it was fed this labeled methionine. And then the cysteine, the new hair that was grown, was shaved off after there was enough of it. And the cysteine was isolated from the hair. And then that cysteine was analyzed. And it was really a beautiful experiment. All the sulfur came from methionine and none of the carbon. So, anyhow, that was... you see, there was a certain... a real intellectual pleasure in doing these kind of experiments, because it was a yes or no business. Either A went to B or it didn't go to B, you see. But you had to have a temperament for it, because some of these experiments lasted months before you got the answer. Also, think of his patience taking a year to make the compound, then taking months to feed it, isolate, and so on, and then analyze it. Now, that, of course, had to be analyzed on a mass spectrometer. And I went up to Rittenberg's lab where he had a mass spectrometer to do the analysis.
Don't want to make a mistake after all of that. So.
I mean, these were experiments that you didn't make mistakes. So that's the kind of work I did at the Vigneaus. I also, was also working on these hormones of the pituitary. And one was called vasopressin, or pressor at that time, and the other is oxytocin. And of course he got the Nobel Prize for his analysis and synthesis of both of those. He synthesized the first active polypeptide hormone, and that's what he got it for. And at that time, they didn't know the composition of it. It wasn't pure. They couldn't possibly. We used to assay for it with animal assays, with biological assays. And he wanted to know the isoelectric point. So I devised apparatus for measuring isoelectric points. And I found, I guess it was the vasopressin. He had beef vasopressin and hog vasopressin. And I found that there was a difference in isoelectric point of almost 2 pH units. Now, I had plenty of the beef stuff, but the hog stuff was rather rare. Hundreds of pituitaries had to be used to get enough material to work with. And so he wouldn't let me publish the hog, you see, because I had only done it twice or something, because I didn't have enough material to do it more often than that. But we did publish the beef. Well, that has an amusing sequel, because many years later he gave a lecture. This was after he had gotten the Nobel Prize. And by this time, they had purified the stuff and so on. They'd done the difference, the hog and the beef. And they differed. One of them had lysine and the other one had arginine. And that was the reason for the isoelectric point difference. So after he gave the lecture, I went up to him and reminded him that I had found this, I don't know how many years earlier. And he really didn't remember. I said, well, you have my notebooks, you can look it up. Because when you left his laboratory, you left your notebooks.
Yeah.
Yes. And that was before the days of duplicate notebooks, you know, where now you have notebooks with carbon
paper.
Mm-hmm. So that you could have a set as well as the boss. But in this case, he kept all the notebooks. You didn't take your notebooks with you.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, he always mentioned this in his lectures, that it had been found many years ago, that they didn't. Anyhow, that's just an amusing sideline. I was in a very special position in his laboratory because I was the only physical chemist they had. All the rest were organic chemists or biochemists, but I was the only physical chemist. And so I was asked to do all kinds of things that I didn't know how to do. Their notion of what a physical chemist should know, such as how to change the telephone lines, he had an internal telephone system, and how to fix the leads in Northrop galvanometer, and so on. But they soon learned that a physical chemist didn't know necessarily how to do all those things. But anyhow, intellectually, I had a very fine time there. I didn't realize that when you're a member of a team, nobody realizes that you exist or that that you have contributed anything. Because the only way I could get out of that place, I had been offered a job and was withdrawn when the person found out that the Vigneaux didn't want me to leave.
He had a good deal of control over what happened to his people.
That's right. He was very paternalistic and very concerned, but he also, he once said to me, he said, I don't know why these people want to leave. He kept his PhD students at least 1 year afterwards as postdocs.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this habit of keeping postdocs. Well, I stayed there 8.5 years. Because he said they were valuable. He said, Warburg used to keep people 20 years. This was in Germany, of course. Anyhow, but he did believe that I should follow my husband around, you see. So when my husband got a job in St. Louis, Washington University, he was very helpful. He wanted to help me get a position in St. Louis. And Corey was in New York, and he for a Harvey lecture, and he invited him to have lunch with him and me too. So I met Corey on that occasion, and he introduced me as his right-hand woman who had been with him for 8 years. And Corey turned to me and said, where have you been these 8 years? Because at that point I was ready to go through the floor. Suddenly hit me that I was an unknown after having worked in this field for 8.5 years, mm-hmm. or 8 years at that time. It was 6 months before I left. Nobody knew that I existed, you see.
I had
published, yes, by that time, about 11 or 12 papers. But Divinio also had a policy that nobody gave a talk at a meeting except himself. Actually, in some ways, that's nice, because when you're a young person going to a meeting now, you never hear the big shots speaking at all.
True.
You hear very often incomprehensible postdocs, foreign postdocs who can't even speak English, or you hear a graduate student or whatever, but you very rarely hear the top people give talks at meetings, mm-hmm. except plenary lectures or something. I mean research talks of current work.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't true in those days, at least not in the Society of Biological Chemists. The big men used to, mm-hmm. and women occasionally, there were very few, but anyhow, used to give these talks. Once he did allow me, I don't know why, it was an invited paper which he and I were both writing, and he said he gave, let me give the talk. But that was an exception to the rule.
But during that period, you also had one paper with Fritz Lippmann.
Oh, yes. Fritz Lippmann was in Divinio's laboratory.
I see.
Okay. Fritz Lippmann was came over for a 2-year stay in Divinio's laboratory. Divinio was very anxious to work on a level other than the whole animal. Tissue slices, enzymes, and so on. But he had no experience. And Lippmann, of course, knew all about that. He was an enzymologist. He knew how to work with tissue slices. He knew how to work with extracts and with pure enzymes. And so it was Dean Burke, whom Divinio thought very highly of, and who came with him for 2 years' stay when Divinio first went to Cornell. Burke was then at the National Cancer Institute, I believe, and he had known him in Washington, you see, and he had him come, and he suggested Lippmann.
B-U-R-K-E?
Mm-hmm. Dean Burke. D-E-A-N Burke. Does he have an E at the end, or does, is it B-U-R-K? No, I'm just trying to remember. Anyhow, it's either, it's B-U-R-K, whether there's an E or not, I don't remember. But he was suggested Lippmann for this.
And Lippmann was where before?
He was in Denmark at the time. He had left Germany. This was 19... Oh, I know just when it was. It was 1939. He had left Germany, and he was in Denmark, but he didn't have a tenured position at all. So he came, and he came in about June, and then the war broke out in September, and he couldn't go back anyhow. But he had planned to stay for 2 years. Maybe he came the year before. I don't think so. I think he came that summer. In any case, he was in Divinio's laboratory for several years. and then he left.